Welcome to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast, part of the center's efforts to cultivate dialogue about university teaching and learning among faculty, students, and staff. I'm your host, Rhett McDaniel, educational technologist here at the center. In this episode, we feature a panel discussion with Kathy Friedman, assistant professor in the Biological Sciences Department, and Ann Kinefield, senior lecturer in the Department of Teaching and Learning in Peabody College. During this panel discussion, Kathy Friedman talks about student misconceptions she's encountered when teaching biological sciences and what she does to address them. Ann Kinefield follows up by sharing with the group her research around inscriptional practices in science and science education.
First person speaking will be Kathy Friedman, who is an assistant professor of biological sciences. She studies the function and regulation of telomerase, which is an enzyme required for chromosome maintenance and that plays an important role in cancer and aging. And I think she uses yeast to do that research, if I'm not mistaken. Her website's very clear. I was actually able to come up with several one-sentence versions of her research from it. So. She regularly teaches the Introduction to Genetics course in the Biological Sciences Department, as well as Molecular Genetics, and maintains an active lab, of course. She's a researcher, in which she employs graduate students and undergraduate students. And I just highlight that because that is, without a doubt, a form of teaching, a pretty active and ongoing form of teaching. Ann Kinefield, to her left and to my right, is a senior lecturer in the Department of Teaching and Learning in Peabody College with a specific emphasis in science education. And her research is on inscriptional practices in science and science education. She has taught introductory biology. Was it in high school or at college?
No, college level in many different settings.
College level in many different settings. She is currently teaching a seminar for student teachers in science, so that is students at Peabody who are going to get a certificate for teaching science in K-12 schools, and also teaching a course on scientific literacy. A direct connection she has to the Department of Biological Sciences here is that she has worked with senior lecturer Mark Wolfley to develop more discovery-based labs. So with that as an introduction to our two panelists, I'm going to ask Kathy to go first and then Ann.
Okay. So thank you very much for asking me today. So I think I'm starting off with the more practical aspects of this topic, and just based on my experiences in teaching genetics and also teaching the students in my lab. And so I thought it was very interesting when I was asked to think about misconceptions that I encounter in the class and how I address that, because in fact I think that the biggest misconception that I see is not one having to do with the topic itself, but rather the misconception I see is that misconception students have about what it actually means to learn biology. And so they come to my class, I think, often thinking that biology is just a lot of facts that you need to memorize. And the idea that if I memorize those facts, then somehow I will be able to do well in this class, because what I will be tested on is my ability to kind of spit back or regurgitate those facts. And so they're often in for a bit of a shock, I think, in my class, because I really like to emphasize concepts in the class and try to push the students to where on exams they might see a situation slightly different from what they've encountered before, and they need to use what we've covered in class in order to be able to address that situation. And so it's very common for me to have students come to my office hours after an exam and say to me, I don't understand what happened, because I know the material. I know the material we covered in class. I just can't show you on the exam. And I'm trying to tell them in as nice a way as I can that, you know, you think you know the material, but you only know it in a certain sense, in the sense of having memorized some lists, for example, but you don't really know. Perhaps there are some aspects of the deeper parts of the material that you don't know as well as you think. And so I feel like a lot of what I've tried to do over the last several years, having encountered this a lot, is trying to figure out ways in class that I can start to move the students a little bit more toward understanding what it is that I, what it is to really know the material and give them practice in doing that. I think I just want to maybe highlight this very quick because these are some comments from the teaching evaluations in my course, and I think that they really kind of highlight several different viewpoints of the students in my class about this issue of being forced to sort of think in a different way than just memorizing. And two of them are quite positive, and then one of them is not very positive. So the first student said, the subject material was very interesting, and I was initially thrown off by how they want to challenge our problem-solving skills rather than remembering facts. I'm glad they did, though, and the things they teach have good importance, so I like the class. The second one, it's one of the most challenging courses I've taken at Vanderbilt, but I never once felt the grading was unfair. It challenged me to think in a different way. I not only learned about the subject of genetics, but also how to think like a geneticist, which thrilled me because that's one, like, our major goal that we have on our syllabus. I gained so much knowledge from this course, and I know it will be invaluable to me now and in the future. So I feel like hopefully those are students for whom they started to get an idea that this was actually a very valuable way to be thinking and to be learning how to think. But I also have comments like this last one where they say, so at least the one thing good about this is that they actually read the syllabus, because they say, the syllabus for this class tells students that they will be taught to think like a geneticist. Although the examination certainly tests this ability, the class does not prepare students to think like a geneticist. You learn the information about genetics, and either when it comes to the test, you can put it together or you can't. I'm not even sure it's possible to teach someone to think like a geneticist. Perhaps you can only teach the information about genetics and hope for the best. Certainly it seems that the department has no problems with this approach, but this approach seems to be turning students away from science and research. Throughout the course of this class, I've seen more than a few of my classmates turn away from the biology major because they say if the rest of the biology major, graduate school, science research, etc. is like this class, they want no part of it. So, you know, sometimes I'm not quite sure what to make with that. It makes me very sad because I want to say, oh, we're just getting to the part that's fun, because the memorization part's not fun. The fun part is putting that together. But I think it suggests that, you know, I have ways in which I could improve kind of reaching out and addressing this issue. So how am I trying to do that to help students understand what I consider really knowing biology or understanding the underlying concepts as opposed to just memorizing. And I've taught this course probably at least 6 times, I think, and so this is still evolving. But we've gradually moved more and more toward having problem sets and practice exams available that really just giving the students as much practice as possible and seeing the types of questions that we're going to want them to be able to answer so that they can start to see what's expected. I think it is true that I've had students tell me that you make it sound so easy during the lecture, and then when I get the question, it's not as easy as you make it sound. And so just really working hard to give them practice so that they see what kinds of questions are expected. That's been fairly helpful. The aspect that, I know we mentioned this when we were chatting last week, the aspect about this that backfires a little bit sometimes are the practice exams. So I post the practice exam, and I do post an answer key because I feel like they need to be able to get some feedback about the questions. But I think what happens a lot, even though I warn them not to do it, is I think they get the practice exam and they get frustrated very quickly. So they peek at the answer on the answer key. And then they convince themselves that they knew how to answer the question. And so over and over, they'll tell me that the practice exam was easier than the in-class exam, even though the practice exam is the in-class exam from the year before, whose students told me that the practice exam was easier than the in-class exam. And I don't think that I'm getting harder every year, although I guess that's possible. But I think that that's something I've tried. That's a misconception, since I think the students have about their own learning also, is that they fool themselves sometimes into thinking they know something because they were able to glance at the answer and then in retrospect understand that that was the answer and fool themselves into thinking that they knew how to get there by themselves. So I try to warn them about that. And we've actually eliminated even offering the answer key, for example, for the book problems. We don't even order that at the bookstore anymore because we felt like we were suggesting they buy the answer key and then telling them to never look at it. So we just rely on them now to come to us, or sometimes we'll post answers, but a week later or so that they have time to work through the problems. I've also started devoting some class time to what I've called concept questions, which again are exam questions that I've taken from previous year's exams. And they're given the questions before class, but then in class, I provide some time for them to discuss how they approach the problem with a few of the neighbors around them in the class. And then ask a few students to volunteer their answers, which are usually very brief, the way that they kind of explain their answer. And then I spend the rest of the time modeling for them how I thought through the problem. So kind of talking through, well, when I see this problem, here are the words that I noticed, and this made me think about this approach or something like that, so that hopefully they can try to make a little transparent the way that I would approach a problem. And I think that that has been helpful. Something else that we did this year, and again, like I said, this is kind of evolving, and this was actually something that my TA put together this last semester, was a lecture where she went through a historical research field, and it had something to do with cancer, and we talked about cancer biology, so it involved some molecules that we had talked about in class. But she went back to some older papers, and she pulled out experiments that they had done, sort of key experiments that were along this route of discovery toward this molecule, that were the types of experiments we had talked about in class. And so I just thought it worked really beautifully that in 15 minutes she was able to hit several very key concepts that we had talked about in class, but hit them in the context of discovery research and allowing students to see, here's this molecule we talked about that's so important for cancer, and here are the experiments that people did as they discovered that molecule. And look, these are the same techniques we've talked about in class, and here's how they were applied. And I think from talking to students, actually, that lecture did a great job of really sort of pulling some things together for them where they might not have seen the connections as well before. So I'm definitely planning to do that in future years, and I might even think about adding another one of those types of lectures if I can. And then the last thing in this section that I just wanted to mention, because I found it very interesting, this was also something that a TA did with me who was working at the Center for Teaching on her teaching certificate, and her project that she did was to do some concept mapping with the students in my class. This was Jennifer Osterhag, 2 years ago, and what was so striking, it was a very short exercise. She just had one day when she did this concept mapping, and she did it on a fairly small section of the course. But when she coded them afterwards, what she wanted to do was compare their concept maps with how they were doing in the course and see if she could find any correlations. And she thought it would have something to do with, the specific connections they made or how complex the map was. But what she actually found correlated best with the way the students were doing in class were not the specific lines they drew between things. Most students actually did that fairly well, but it was the words that they then placed on those lines to make those connections. And so the students who used very concrete words, this always means this, or this dictates this, were the ones who were doing less well. And the ones who were doing very well in class were writing, this can mean this, this sometimes means this. They were recognizing that there weren't necessarily concrete rules in every case. They were beginning to see the subtleties of the connections between things, and that when you draw a line, there may be situations where that line is really representative, and there may be times when that is not as representative. If anybody has ideas later, it'd be great. I'd like to find a way to actually somehow incorporate this into my class as an exercise to somehow help students begin to move toward understanding that these connections are more subtle, but I haven't quite figured out how to do that yet. But I found that that was just kind of a revelation for me, and I thought that was very interesting. And I think it relates to something I have seen frequently, which is that when we do a review session, for example, in class, as students are preparing for exams, you're always asking me for lists, especially for techniques. So, you know, if there's a certain technique, give us a list of when you would use this technique. And I am trying hard to help them move away from the idea that memorizing a list of when a technique should be used is not the best approach, that what you need to do is really understand what the technique tells you and what sort of information the technique gives you. And if you understand that, then you don't need the list because you can figure it out. And again, I'm still struggling with how to kind of start to move them away from that. But I think it all comes back to this idea that they think if I memorize the list, then I can do well in the exam. And the problem is that the fact that they need to memorize a list really means they don't understand it deeply enough to apply it the way that I would like them to be able to apply it. Okay, so hopefully we can come back later and talk about that a little more. Am I okay? Forgot what time I started. I don't know what time I started. So I'll go real quickly through the other two because there may be a little bit more specific to biology. So, but I was thinking of some other more specific misconceptions, I think, that that students bring with them to a biology class. So one is definitely in the scale of molecular biology. So students have a really hard time thinking of things on such a tiny scale. And we make this worse, and this ties into my other point here, but we make this worse by the way we draw things, because obviously if we draw a piece of DNA, we can't, there might be a million of those pieces in a tube, but we can't draw them all, so we draw one. And then I think they start to think that there's one piece of DNA in the tube. And this is can be very problematic to them when they're thinking of techniques. So the main way that I've tried to approach this misconception is mostly by telling them that it exists. So I think this is a case where trying to point out to the students that I know that this is a common misconception and is helpful, and to acknowledge to them that I am only drawing one, but in fact there are millions of these identical DNA molecules in the tube. And the other thing I've done is try to give them a sense of scale a little bit. So this is just an example of one little exercise that we do. So I don't have clickers, but I use little cards that they can hold up as long as they remember to bring them. And so this was right when I start introducing molecular biology, really. And so I asked them that if DNA had a diameter of 2 millimeters, and the actual diameter is 2 nanometers, so it's a millionfold larger in scale than it really is, how long would the DNA in a single human cell be? Okay. And the answer is D, which hardly any of them guess. Oh, which is 2,000 kilometers, for those of you on the tape. And then I tell them that that's the distance from Nashville to Denver. So I have this kind of, I had this great idea that I was going to give them a really visual representation of this, actually, before I calculated this. So this tells you that my sense of scale isn't right either. So I thought, I'm going to just take one chromosome from humans, and I'm going to bring that much yarn to class so that we can kind of pass it around the class and see how long it is. And then I calculated that I'd have to buy 84 skeins of yarn, and I decided that that wasn't such a great idea after all. But I tell them that story too, right? And so by the end of that, I think they're starting, and I try to emphasize, that's one, you know, for one chromosome, that's one DNA molecule. It's that long, and so that starts to open up some ideas. Well, gosh, you can't have something that long and have it never break, and we can think about repair. And so trying to do some kind of fun things that shock them a little bit sometimes, I think helps counteract that a little bit, at least. Although I still see that creeping in frequently. And then the last thing very quickly is that, and this is probably true in all disciplines, but I don't know, maybe it's worse in biology, but many of the diagrams and the language that we use are actually very misleading to students in ways that you don't realize until you really start looking carefully at what you're doing. So just as a quick example, it's very traditional when we draw recombination to only draw the two chromatids that are involved in the recombination event, even though there are actually two other DNA molecules always that are not involved in that recombination event. And then we get frustrated later that the students forget that there are four DNA molecules there. Well, we never draw the other two, so how are they supposed to remember that they're there? And so I've tried to become much more explicit about when I'm drawing things, about even if I don't draw all four, because sometimes it can be confusing to have all four there, to at least point out to the students repeatedly that I am only drawing the two that are involved. And also, for example, we tend to draw lines to represent DNA, but sometimes it represents the DNA double helix, sometimes it represents a single strand, and again, being very explicit with them, I always know what I mean when I draw a line, but they may not know. So being explicit about that. And then finally, being careful about the language that we use too, because we have a lot of shortcut language that we use in our discipline, and I've been learning over the years which of those pieces of language are particularly confusing to students. And really, I think the best way to counteract that is to have students explain things back to you, because I can hear in the language they're using as well whether they understand something. But that is obviously something that's tricky to do in a lecture context.
Now we'll hear from Ann Crankfield.
Okay. It just occurred to me like 30 seconds ago that I'll just say something funny here at the beginning about my relationship with Kathy. She and I met a year or so ago because of some work I was doing over in Peabody, but my science background is in genetics, and 25 years ago I used to work in a yeast lab that worked on cell cycle mutations, which is what part of what Kathy's work is, and I sat in on a group meeting one day and it was like, oh my god, 25 years ago we knew this, and now look at what she's telling me. It's like we had these mutants that we didn't know anything about, and now she's telling me what they produce, you know, what these genes produce. And so it was really kind of fun to kind of get that sense. And so she and I have a way of actually speaking a little bit more deeply to each other about the pedagogical issues, because I know what I sort of understand what she's talking about, I mean, in terms of the content. So anyway, I just think it's kind of interesting. I'm gonna start with this overview, which is this little diagram at the top here. And I do want to get back to connecting to some of what Kathy said, because when I get near the end, I'm going to be saying a few things that Kathy is a great example of doing really good things as an instructor. But the top is just this overview of research on misconceptions and conceptual change in science and science education. And what many people hear and believe is that misconceptions are these, you know, these coherent structures that students come into their classrooms with, and if they're there, they're going to create problems for them learning the thing that they need to learn, and therefore they need to be identified and eradicated. And that's sort of called the coherence model, and I'm starting there because I want to tell everybody right now that this is no longer the dominant view of misconceptions from anyone who does this kind of research. And so I want to get into what the subtleties are. But at the very top, there's actually sort of three modes of doing this research, or three, in some ways, think of them as camps, that there's people who do very cognitive research, and what their interest is just looking at mental representations in the head, you know, surmising what these are, and trying to help people change those and figure out what's going on when that happens. There's the sociocognitive folks who sort of acknowledge and pay a little bit of attention to the interactions that occur when students are working on developing a concept, or even an interaction that occurs like in a clinical interview with somebody who knows what's going on and you're doing this back and forth. But that's still very much this mental representation in the head kind of thing. On the other side, is the sociocultural folks who come out of an activity theory tradition, and they really focus on the social interactions in classrooms or whatever settings they happen to be looking at, through which understandings of, and the development of scientific conceptions emerge. And so it's a much more, it's focused much more on not collective consciousness, that's not that's not the concept that I'm referring to, but what comes out of the collective working together on trying to understand something. I don't want to talk any more about that because it's a whole huge debate that we could spend several days on and still come to no agreement. So, but I noted here, and so then the cognitive, both of the cognitive views, there's the coherence model, and then there's what's sort of called the knowledge in pieces model, that term coined by Andy DeSessa, who happened to be here last week giving a talk. So those two views, the difference is there's this resistant, eradicate, it's really coherent, we got to get rid of it. There's people now who are still sort of in mainly that camp who acknowledge that they're pretty clear in their own work that this coherence thing doesn't really work out, and that eradication is really a problematic way to think about dealing with misconceptions. And that's related to the knowledge in pieces, where the image is that the knowledge that people have is somewhat fragmented, and that that different pieces have differential utility. So in a physics world, I might want to say I have this whole model of where's the sun in relation to the earth, and when the sun comes over the horizon, what's happening, and blah, blah, blah. But if somebody says to me, oh, where does the sun rise from your house? I go, oh, right over there. And it has nothing to do with my model of the solar system or anything like that. It's just the sun rises. We feel perfectly comfortable saying that, even though we want to convince students, and rightfully so, if we want them to understand the scientifically accepted version, that it's not that the sun is, it's not that we're Earth-centric and the sun is coming up around and that there's this whole other model and way of thinking about it. But the knowledge in pieces view basically says there's these different things, they get built together as you learn more and more about a particular area of research or learning, and that, in fact, some of the things that really don't work well in science continue to work well in your everyday life, and there's no reason to get rid of them. And they're really unproblematic for the most part. So, and these are like cartoon views of these different things. So, that's kind of the landscape in which this happens. And different groups have a hard time sometimes talking to each other, you know, which is not surprising. And even within a group, you know, there's these people always cite this group over here, and these people always cite this group over here, but for some reason they're doing something very similar, but the people who are cited here don't cite the people over here. And so there's all that kind of interesting dynamic. But all of them assume that knowledge is constructed and that no human ever, there's virtually no time, except maybe the instant that you're born, that a human is a blank slate. That's basically the underlying belief. So these things that we talk about, misconceptions, they've been given different names, which are listed there. Misconceptions is the one that has sort of stuck in a lot of ways, although people often will distinguish between misconceptions and naive conceptions, naive conceptions being the things that you just, from your own phenomenological experience, that's just what you get. And they tend to be common because we all experience friction and we all experience certain things. And so those also are somewhat common, but they really don't come out of, they just come out of your own experience. So what we want to go back to then, or next down the line, is what are the sources of misconceptions? So the first one I just mentioned is this phenomenological experience issue, which I think is pretty straightforward. And those kinds of things tend to be somewhat developmental, and as children grow up, and I'm not a developmentalist in the sense of, you know, stage theory or anything like that, because I think kids of various ages can do lots of different kinds of things, but that as children develop their cognitive capacities, they're able to sort of take in what are the things that I'm learning in relation to this experience that I have in the world, although a lot of that experience in the world are the things that Andy DeSessa would say, so what if they're there? Because they're totally functional in certain contexts, and it's just not an issue. The other place where misconceptions come from is schooling, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. There's misconceptions that come from belief systems, and I'm using the example of evolution because I think that evolution is a very unusual misconception, and I just want to sort of put that out, because there are two things that we can mean by, or there's two ways in which you can have a misconception about evolution. One is that you just don't understand, like you might have this, people have talked about students having a Lamarckian view, and it's really easy to think that way because it's because of what you can't see in the Darwinian view, and so it's a little bit more complicated thing to understand. And so that really is something that you need to work with, looking at data, looking at evidence, and those kinds of things. There's another way to have this misconception that I'm sure we're all well aware of, which is that your religious belief system won't accept it. And that is very different. And it's not something that, I don't think it's something that even can be really very productively dealt with through instruction, even though I think it's important to provide. There's a lot of evidence that's given to them on one side. I think it's important for them to hear that there is this other whole set of understandings, and in fact, you know, virtually every scientist on the planet thinks that it works this way. But it's a different kind of misconception, and I say this because I don't like to lump it in with all the other ones. So given the opportunity to talk about misconceptions, I thought I would do that. And then Kathy just mentioned one that's not on there, which I think is really important, which is the nature of the domain. And I think domains tend to be somewhat different from others. And if we talked about, oh, what are the problems in physics versus biology, we would see some different kinds of problems that come up. And I think in biology and probably in lots of things, there's kind of this general simplicity, complexity thing. How far do I go? They don't really understand it if they don't get this. But this is so complex, it's like, why would they ever understand that, given that they don't even have sort of a fundamental structure on which to hang that information? So I think that that's also very important. I wanted to turn to schooling as a source. And I've listed a few things here. The first one is that there's instructor issues that range from just gaps in knowledge, which is tends to be pretty common, especially among, say, elementary school teachers, because they've actually not had a whole lot of science instruction. And the science instruction they've had is typically sitting in large lecture halls having somebody talk at them for an hour three times a week. And that's pretty problematic. And it goes all the way up to what I call expertise clouded thinking. And the opposite of that is going into a teaching situation with beginner's mind, a la Suzuki Roshi. So to open that up a little bit, what I'm talking about is experts having difficulty recognizing the kinds of things, the ways in which their knowledge is put together that really don't work for students, because students are coming from a very different, or novices are coming from a very different place. And what's really useful is to sort of get to that beginner's mind place, which a lot of the time is extremely hard to do. That you don't even remember what it was like to be a beginner when you're an expert. And so it's hard to put yourself back in that position, but it's a very useful thing to try and pay attention to. There's also all of these constraint issues, which have to do with they put you in a large lecture hall with 100 people for 1 hour three times a week. What are you supposed to do? You're pretty constrained in that situation. There's also scheduling issues. Why is it just 1 hour three times a week? Why is the lab 3 hours one time a week? You know, those kinds of things that are really just endemic in the system. And then there's, you know, resource issues. What's available to actually help students develop the kinds of understandings that you would like them to develop? I think that the lecture hall format, sort of the next bullet point, kind of promotes this practice that follows a teaching is talking and learning is listening model. And I think that it is just, it's the dominant model of education, I think, in many domains, science in particular, at the university, college, university level. It's traditional. It's the way that it's always been done, and that's how we do it. So, and we do it in the context of the kinds of constraints that we're facing. And believe me, when I say any of these things, I mean, I've taught in these exact situations, and I, you know, this is not an indictment of anybody's practice. It's really like trying to raise some awareness of the situation that you're in and how that doesn't really fit where the students are coming from. And then there's all sorts of issues about what your beliefs as an instructor are about what it means to understand science or to be scientifically literate. It means many different things to different people. If you go into the scientific literacy literature, it is mind-boggling the different ways that this is defined. Now, I brought a little example with me because do people know this book, Science Matters, Hazen and Trafell? I know some science people really, like, you know, keep this by their side because this is supposed to be about, it's called Achieving Scientific Literacy from Plate Tectonics to Leptons, so the first living cell. Now you can understand the simple science behind our complex world. I'll tell you what I think of this book in a second. But I want to read something. And first I'll ask you a question. How many people here could explain to me what a semiconductor is and what it does, how it functions in the world? Anyone?
A tiny bit?
Anybody else, even a tiny bit? Okay, this is one of the things that Hazen and Trafell think that every student should walk out of college, all of us, every person who is scientifically literate should know this. Let's see. Okay, they start, like cultural literacy, scientific literacy does not refer to detailed, specialized knowledge, the sort of things an expert would know. When you come across a term like, superconductor, I'm sorry, in a newspaper article, it is enough to know that it refers to a material that conducts electricity without loss, that the main impediment to the widespread use of superconductors is that they operate only at very low temperatures, and that finding ways to is that they operate only at very low temperatures and remove this impediment is a major research goal in material science today. Did anybody know that? Do you consider yourselves literate people? So you may guess at this moment that I would not recommend you keep, if you're teaching science, you keep this book next to you, because I think that is a very bad guide as to what it means to be scientifically literate, because it just sort of goes on like that for the rest of the book. And that, in my mind, is coming from an expert-clouded thinking that sees that as a simplistic explanation of something. So, it's always good to use an example. That's something to do in instruction. Always use an example that can really grab people. Like, I think Kathy pointed that out quite a bit. So then at the end, I did want to say this whole thing about understanding and being scientifically literate, and it ties into something Kathy was talking about, and I wanted to define this word. For those of you who don't know what it means to say that I or anybody else does work in inscriptional practices, it just means representations of all sorts, diagrams, even lists, you know, any text that is really formatted in a way that makes it sort of distinct from prose, could be mathematical equations. I mean, it's all of those kinds of things. And where the term came from, and not everybody in the field even uses it, but it's become quite popular because it was an attempt to distinguish between inscriptions as the things that are external in the world that we can see, that people produce, that people can pass around to each other and things like that, as opposed to mental representations. So it was just like, let's give these two different names so that we can always know which one we're talking about. So I like that. So I am in the inscriptions camp as opposed to the representations camp. But part of what it means to understand science, I don't think we think about a lot, is it's not just the words, it's the inscriptions, it's the inscriptional practices, it's the gestures we make, it's what we think the scientific method is, which I don't think there is the scientific method, and we can, you know, we can talk about that when we have time.
And, you know, I think if you're ready to move to what's an instructor to do, I'm going to ask you to bracket that for the question and answer period so that we can have some questions for Kathy before she goes.
Oh, no, that's, yeah, I'm sorry.
And presumably there are questions in
that will come up in the question and answer period that will allow you to go to that.
That was Kathy Friedman, assistant professor in the Biological Sciences Department, and Ann Kinefield, senior lecturer in the Department of Teaching and Learning in Peabody College. See the show notes for this podcast for additional links and resources. You can view the show notes as well as leave comments or questions about this episode by visiting blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast. If you'd like to share how you have addressed student misconceptions, we encourage you to stop by our website and join the discussion. Vanderbilt instructors are also welcome to call the center at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with a CFT teaching consultant to discuss strategies you can employ to minimize student misconceptions in your class. Thanks for listening to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast. Please join us for future episodes by visiting the podcast homepage at blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast. Or by subscribing to the podcast through iTunes or a similar program. I've been your host, Rhett McDaniel.